Now for the moment you've all been waiting for. It is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Let's welcome Greg.
So let's get the sound right. Is this too loud or you want me to back up? Okay. I hate it when it's just blasting in my ears. My name is Greg. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 15, 1999. Bill H. calls me every year on my birthday. I always ask him, he either has a great memory or he has a great calendar program. He says it's both. Anyway, and when he called me on Monday morning, he asked me to come in and fill in tonight, and here I am. Those of you that are new and you find it uncomfortable to stand up and say you're an alcoholic, I am one of you. I didn't get here on a winning streak. I didn't think alcohol was my problem. I thought that my living circumstances were my problem. And it took four interventions. And finally, I just saw the light and off to a treatment center I went. It's interesting to me to note that when I was in that center and I was learning about the disease of alcoholism, and one of the things that happened during that stay was an anger management class that thoroughly pissed me off. And no one in that house, I think there was 22 or 23 people in this facility, got any work done that day, because this insane person was in their business trying to fix their problems so that I didn't have to deal with me. I thought they should have locked me up, you know, but that's not what they decided to do. And when I met with my counselor, he gave me some great advice, and it still carries with me today. He asked me if I felt insane, and I said, yes, I did. He asked me if I had some kind of higher power, and I said, yeah, I think so. He asked me if I would do anything that he asked, and I said, you bet, I want out of this pain. He suggested to me that I go to my bunk. I was in this little dorm with, I don't know, probably six or eight guys. And he suggested that I call up that higher power and ask him. I heard him say beg. Beg this power greater than me to relieve the insanity. And I did that. And it came from down in my gut. It didn't come from some thought. It came from some emotion deep inside of me. And I wept. I was 43 years old. I hadn't cried since I was a young guy. You know, I was raised by one of those dads that, you know, if you got swatted and you cried, well, he just gave it to you a little bit more, you know. And so I became a real tough guy. Being shorter than Bill also helped being a tough guy. The point is, something happened to me, and I woke up the next day, and according to the staff, I was remarkably different. And I have not had a thought of drinking or using any substance since then. It was gone. To me, that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the miracle of bringing a power greater than myself into my life-living problems and getting between me and the thought of those. The rest of this story is about how to live alcohol-free. And that's been the challenge for me, because this thing never shuts up. It keeps running. And detaching from that has been a continuing battle for me. So along the way, you know, I got involved with a sponsor and working steps and doing and going to lots of meetings and doing the things that were suggested to me. And when I left that treatment center, they sent me to you. And they said that I should come and see you every day, and I should do that for a long period of time. They said 90 days, but my counselor said, you know, you're a special breed. I think you should do this for a year. And he also designed the kind of meetings I should go to, you know, like a book study and a step study and a speaker meeting like this and a closed meeting. that I wouldn't like to have gone to a woman's meeting, but he meant a men's meeting. I've still been trying to get into those women's meetings. They won't let me go. My gal keeps telling me, she says, "You were raised by women," and I am. You know, I've always got women around me because I relate to women. There wasn't any guys in my house, you know, except that dad that wanted to beat me, you know. But the women in my house, all my sisters and what have you, they spoiled me. That's probably part of the problem. So I did all these meetings, and my life got worse. I worked steps. My life got worse. I was trying to live my program in my own home externally. And I think that's really what was going on, is I was trying to get this program intellectually. I was trying to live it as a suit of armor. I was trying to teach you what I was learning. I thought maybe if I taught you about it, then maybe I would get it. I was doing the opposite of what I was trained in that period of time when I begged this maker to relieve me of the insanity. That came from down in my gut. That wasn't in my head. And, you know, my wife had shown up to the family day at this treatment center and had arrived with a goodbye letter and a restraining order. You know, she told the staff, "You keep him. He's no longer welcome in Porterville, and I have changed the locks." And they convinced her that they saw something different, because it was after this little episode, you know, where I begged this power greater than me to remove that insane thinking. She allowed me to come home. But there were conditions, you know. She had been to enough Al-Anon, and they talked about these boundaries. And one of the boundaries was, you know, returning to that insane thinking. And there came a day when she had invited my sponsor over for coffee. And we're sitting around the table. And I'd had four interventions, and this felt like one of those. And it turns out it was more than an intervention. It was an exit. You don't live here anymore. You got to go. And so I went down and stayed at the local motel for a few days, thinking this, hopefully, is brief. And it wasn't brief. And it went on. And it went on. And so I had this metal building, you know, that had a couple of offices in it, and I cleaned those offices out and made an apartment, and I moved in there, and I lived in this steel building for a year. But the interesting thing that happened for me in this steel building is I'm all alone. I can't work this program externally anymore. I've got to figure out, there's no one there. And I returned to some things that was going on in that treatment center, you know, where you wake up in the morning and you read something spiritual, and you kind of get connected with this God thing, and you look for a little guidance, and I'm back on my knees and I'm begging again. I want the restoration of my family now. I'm in deep pain. I'm still going to meetings, still working with the sponsors, still working steps. I'm working with a guy that his take on this inventory was different than where I'm going to end up in this discussion with you. You know, the inventory reads that we made a fearless moral inventory. And I think I was interpreting it, or was exposed to a thinking that it was fearful and immoral. In other words, all the dirty, rotten things that I had done, as opposed to why did I do them? Or what was the thought process behind them? And what kind of guilt or fear was I carrying around associated with that, meaning I'd violated some value that I held dear, some code. And so this during this period of time, I'm in my second year, and I'm not happy. I'm trying to get in touch with this power greater than me. I'm having to let go of some things, and I made a sponsor change. And the fellow that God directed me to was one that really practiced the fearless moral inventory, and he explained to me that it's really about my values, and it's about my code, and the way I see the world. And when I violate my code, then I'm unhappy. And so I need to take a look at my values and see if they continue to hold water for me. So I'm unraveling a little bit here, and I'm trying to work with somebody new, and I'm trying to get back in the house, and you know, and there came a time when it was like, this ain't working. Maybe it's time to call up an attorney, you know. And the interesting thing was, is there was a fellow in the program who was an attorney, not that he would handle this kind of case, but maybe he could direct me where I needed to be. And I had a conversation with him about the potential of this. And I think this power greater than me spoke to me through him. And he told me, he says, why don't you go and sit down with your wife and just see if there's some common ground. Make an attempt to see if there is any hope here. So I called her up and asked her if I could come over, and she said, yeah, okay. And she's expecting some kind of hurricane. And our dining room table is a long table, you know, a rectangle. And my seat was always at the end of the table, you know, sort of holding court. And this time I sat at the side of the table, across from her. And what she told me was, is that I spoke from my heart, not from my head. You see, this power that's greater than me was beginning to restore things that I had asked for months before. It's in his time, not mine. Mine's to do the unraveling so that I be prepared so that when the opportunity comes, I'm better equipped to carry the message. So I shared with her how I felt, what was important to me. Really didn't make an amends. I don't think I was ready for that, but I shared what was in my heart. And when I left there, there was enough hope, enough energy that, you know, we began to seek some professional help, and my family was restored. And I was able to move back in. And it was different. It was sort of like when I had made that plea to a higher power about relieving me of the insanity, I had a certain freedom. And when I made this plea with her and we worked through the mechanics of how do you live together, there was a certain freedom. And as we continued down that path, things began to get even freer. And it was around that time that I had become quite involved in general service. You know, at some point I'd become the area literature chair, and I was traveling around a lot on weekends, and she started going with me. And she was a bit of an Al-Anoner, but she didn't understand us. You see, to a normie, we don't really have a disease. We have a problem with choices. You know, we have a choice of whether we pick up or not. I don't know about you, but I lost that choice a long time before I got here. But when she started traveling around and hearing other people's stories and relating those to her own experience, she began to understand that we are sick and that there is hope and that there is a path for us of recovery. And it energized her. And so we began to you know, become a sobriety couple, you know, doing things that would complement each other, you know. One time we're at PRASA in Portland, and you know, I'm just there as a member of District 47 from Tulare County, and she had filled out some form, yes, I'll participate in an Al-Anon program. She becomes a speaker at the Al-Anon luncheon. And she was very uncomfortable with that. But what she shared was what she would share, you know, just like you or me. All I can share is my experience. And it created gratitude, you know, in our home. So at some point, you know, as I'm continuing to work this inventory process, I begin to learn that there are other pieces of that. You know, there's this sixth and seventh step, you know. In this sixth step, we talk about these defects of character and becoming entirely ready to let go of those. Well, when I'm in pain, I'm ready. Let's let go of that. But later on, you know, my diseased mind, my ego begins to kind of pull back some of that and look at the seductive features of it. You know, if I let go of that, then I'll never get to experience this again. You know, and so the entirely portion of that step sort of gets lost, truncated. And I've wrestled with that step over and over again, because when I made a commitment to be entirely free of alcohol and allow God to get between me and that thought, so why would I not do that with something else like sugar? Sugar is very seductive, you know, and it tastes good, and it comes in different forms, and it's associated with pies and cakes, and, you know, and ice cream, and so pretty soon I'm not willing to deal with that step anymore. And my sponsor taught me that I have a responsibility, and that is once I have become absolutely ready to let go of some defect, I must give it to my Maker. And when I give it to Him, I don't own it anymore. It's not mine. It belongs to Him. And if I take it back, then I've stolen from Him. You know, I thought, well, shit, I don't want to steal anything from anybody, especially not from my Maker. And He's been very patient with me as I go through this yo-yo effect of giving it away and taking it back, you know. And eventually, I learned that if I really wanted to get closure on this thing, I had to get to that ninth step. And go to those people that I had harmed and somehow deal with that. And so my first ninth step amends, not an apology, but an amends, trying to correct this behavior that began with a discovery in my fourth step and leading up to a point of saying, God, it's yours, I'm done with it, and here's how I'm going to find closure on this, was with that first sponsor. You see, when I fired him, I did it in a... It was an interesting fashion. I sent him a dozen roses. And I just said, I love you. And he calls me up and he says, what does this mean? And I said, well, I don't know. And he says, well, are you telling me goodbye or are you telling me hello? And I said, well, I think I'm saying I'm sorry, but I'm saying goodbye, you know. And he was hurt because he didn't really know what he had done, you know. And so there was a certain amount of guilt that he was carrying around. And by making an amends, my job then is to take responsibility for my actions. And so I met with him and I shared with him that the way I did it was wrong, that I felt like I needed to move on to a different type of recovery, of discovery. And I appreciated everything he did for me. He was the right guy for the first three steps. I mean, I don't know about you when you got here, but I was really sick. And I was filled with anxiety, and I needed guidance, and I couldn't put thoughts together very well. And he helped me with that. So I made my amends with him the way that I was taught, and that is I write them out, I review them with somebody else so that it looks like I'm sticking to my side of the street, it has nothing to do with the other person, and I'm keeping it spiritual. I'm keeping my ego out of it. It set me up for the next amends, and the next amends was a very deep one. So this guy that used to, you know, beat me a little bit as a child also was an abuser with other people in my home. And he was dead. But I'd always held my mother accountable. You know, like she should have protected my sisters. She maybe should have protected me, you know. The point is that somebody needed to be responsible, and I decided it was her. And as I worked through my inventory process, I recognized two things. One, that I could only do a burning letter amends with my father. He was deceased. And number two, that I was an heir. My mother had done the very best she could to survive it. It wasn't her fault. And by me holding her accountable all those years, I had not only damaged my relationship with her, but I had loaded her up with guilt that she didn't understand. And I learned that from trying to make this amends with this first sponsor. So I began to recognize that God was utilizing this inventory process, this process from 4 through 9 in a building process. Okay, so I learned a little bit from this one, and it's applied to the next one. So she, after my dad had died, she had moved to Reno to live with her family. It was up there, just get the heck out of Porterville and forget all of that drama, and moved up there. And Prasa that year was in Reno. I was going to be there. I called her up and asked if I could have dinner with her on a Saturday night. And that was, how many years did we figure that it was? 2002. I was there last week to visit with my mother, and I mentioned that. She says, yes, I remember we went to Benihana's. So I skipped the banquet, went to dinner with my mother. I shared what I just shared with you, how I'd held her accountable, and it was wrong, and it wasn't her fault. And she pulled out her laundry list of resentments with me and rattled those off. And it was my job to just sit there and say, yes, you're right. And even today, that's very powerful. It brings up an emotion that is, it's not sadness. It's the joy of realizing that I'm human now. I was inhuman when I was holding her accountable. I'm human when I can respect her. This lady has been undergoing cancer treatments for 5 years or so. And I always stay at the Nugget for whatever reason. I've been staying there for 20 years. I have no idea why. I don't gamble. I know why. They have a bakery there that makes really good pie. And if I take somebody with me who really likes pie, we have pie every night. I like pie. So as I was leaving to come home last Friday, I'm walking down the ramp to get in my car, And I recognized that about 5 years ago, there is a photograph in my home of my wife, my mother, and I. And my mother's wearing a wig. And I recognized that we had made a decision that we were not going to just make an annual visit. We were going to, as frequently as we could, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, we were going to go and visit. God, it's been 5 years, you know, she's still fighting. When I made that amends with her, it was like, okay, you said your piece. And I left there with the knowledge, somewhere, this knowledge came to me to just be patient. Allow God to do what He's going to do, and it will come about when it's supposed to come about, meaning the family will be restored. My relationship with her would be restored. It took 10 years? It took 10 years. And she came one winter and stayed with me for 3 months. She doesn't like the cold up there. And she would usually stay with one of my sisters in Porterville. And there were years that she'd be there for 2 or 3 months and I didn't even know it. You know, she still had her resentments. But she came and she stayed with me before this cancer thing started. And it was wonderful. You know how as you get older and somebody passes and you think about, gee, I wish I'd asked about that family member or where we came from or some little piece of your history, your lineage. And when that person's gone, you say, shit, I missed that chance. And I had her in my home for 3 months and I'd get up in the morning and I'd make a pot of coffee and she and I would sit there for an hour and talk about all that stuff. And God worked in the space between the words. There was tremendous healing that took place. And when she left, there was a closeness. There was a knowing. There was an understanding. There was the experience of love. Not the word love. It was an action. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't made that amends. So that wife got sick and died 2 years ago. I think I was here 2 years ago and shared that story. And what I didn't share with you, because it hadn't happened yet, is there was huge drama that popped up in my family after that. I have 2 sons, 2 adult sons. They had wives. They had children. And we're at this public gathering 9 months later. And my 2 daughter-in-laws are like that, clawing at each other, you know. And it was very embarrassing, you know. I'm there with all my friends, and the event was dedicated to the memory of this lady. And these two women are. It was vulgar. Not just in the verbal sense, it was nasty, you know. And so these 2 men, my sons, come to their aid. And the next thing I know, these guys are swinging at each other. And so my friends pull them apart. And I'm sitting there at the table thinking, I don't want to be here. I want to get out of here, you know. I want to just slide out the back door and, you know, and let this thing dissipate. And as I try to get out and get in my car and drive away, one of my sons comes to me and he wants to explain it. And I said, there's nothing to explain. I said, look, you both behaved badly. You all behaved badly. I just want to go home. What he heard was, you think it's my fault and I behave badly. You see, that's our thought process. That's the way we skew things in our mind. And then I start getting these long emails from my older daughter-in-law that are just, won't read them. I mean, I can just tell from the first paragraph that it's not healthy for me to read this. But there might be something in there that I need to know, so I'll forward it to somebody else. I'll forward it to you. You call me up and tell me what it says. So I have a friend, and I send it to him, and he read it, and he calls me back, and he says, "I think your daughter-in-law is unhinged." I said, "Well, yeah, that's obvious." "But is there something in here I need to work on?" He says, "I don't know. I don't think so." So a little later, I get another installment. And this time I send it to a female friend. And I said, "What do you think?" And she says, "I think we need to meet." And I said, "Oh, okay." So we get together and we go to a breakfast. And she says, she asks a question. "Tell me about your amends with your sons." Fuck. It was like I got hit with a brick, you know. I realized I had made amends with their mother, but I had not made amends with them. And I'm getting ready to fly to Idaho the next day to be with the friend that I'd sent the first email with. And I recognize that this was supposed to be a recreational trip, and it's going to be a work trip. I've got inventory work to do. And I get there, and I'm sitting with my friend John, you know, and I'm just kind of sharing things, and I begin to realize that I can't make an amends with these two boys until I finish my amends with my deceased spouse. I had held my mother accountable for some things, and I had held my wife accountable for some things. I hadn't taken full responsibility. And as I wept and wrote out that inventory, you know, and I prepared for my ninth step, painful, but it was freeing. And so I get home, and I had written this thing out, and I'm trying to decide how I'm going to do this. And Martha takes care of my house, and she had snapped this photograph of Linda a month or so before she passed, and it hangs in my office at home. And you know, I talk to that photograph every day. I get a text message on the 18th of October. So this is about a month after this blow up with the daughter-in-laws. And it's from my daughter-in-law, who likes to send the emails. And this one's a text message, so that one I had to read. And she just says, "I know it's a tough day, but I just want to wish you a happy anniversary." And it was our 41st anniversary. And I began to cry, and I knew today is the day. So I checked out, turned the phone off, and I made my amends with her. And I took full responsibility for my part. And I released her spirit of that. You know, the problem with the resentment is it puts us all in bondage. You know, when I resent you, I'm in bondage, but so are you. And when I make an amends with you, I break that bond. I release it. God evaporates that negative connection. And that's what happened here. And it freed us. It created an opportunity for me to begin to live again. When my wife's memorial, my mother was getting in her car to drive back to Reno, and she says to me, I've appointed your daughter-in-law the gatekeeper. And I said, what the hell is that? And she says, well, you've never dated. You know, Linda and I became an item at age 16, and that's just the way it was. And, you know, these women are going to start flocking around here, and somebody needs to watch out for you because you don't know what's going on. And I said, okay. And then when my daughter-in-law attacks me with these blazing emails, I fired her. Said, you know, she didn't have the right to be my gatekeeper. But what took place then was this opportunity for me to get in touch with this power greater than me and ask for the guidance. I wasn't just asking for you to take, for him to take some pain from me. I was now asking for, do I need a mate? Not need a mate. If I need a mate, or I deserve a mate, or I want a mate, what are the characteristics? And we began to define those characteristics. And it took a while. It took some deep meditation, and it took about 4 months. But the answers came. You know, and every bit of what I'm trying to tell you tonight is that this God of my understanding keeps bringing me the answer. And it's not an answer from my ego. And I needed to test that, because what about these characteristics? Are they characteristics that just please me in some kind of sick way of, you know, an addiction I don't want to let go of? You know, like sugar? Or is it something else? So it was about the degrees of peace. And as I gained confidence in this direction, what happened was the person that I'm supposed to walk the path with at the moment appeared. She had always been there. I didn't know it. And it came, I believe, with the blessing of my deceased spouse. One of the characteristics was that somebody who could embrace the memory of this deceased woman without jealousy or envy, that could come into the home that she created, not the house I bought, but the home she created, and be comfortable in it and not want to make wide changes, you know, like rip up the carpet or something. And that happened. Each part of what I'm sharing with you tonight has confirmed with me that there is a God, I'm not Him, and He cares for me. And my job is to let go of my ideas and embrace the love that He puts in front of me. And that's where I'm at today. And I've enjoyed coming and sharing my 19th sobriety anniversary with all of you. I cannot believe that I could put that together. You know, when you're at 30 days, you get that little aluminum chip. And at 60 days, you get another aluminum chip. And at 90 days, you get another aluminum chip. And you got them in your pocket, and you're nervous as hell, and you're rubbing the paint off of them. And I just kept thinking, I made it 30 days, and I made it 60 days. And then pretty soon, I got a real medallion. You know, and that first year was tough. And the years since then have just been clicking by. But I still, even today, I have to continue to work on these living problems. You know, these things that if I would just let go and let God, and I don't know who came up with that, but they didn't give me the how-to recipe on this let go and let God. I had to find it out on my own. Oh, I got to quit thinking about the problem and living in the solution. And the solution's a power greater. Oh, I'm supposed to think about God. I'm supposed to think about this power greater than me, rather than think about the problem so that he can go and fix the problem, because every time he gave me free will, he won't interfere with it. And when I exercise that free will, he stops working. But when I third step it and give it to him, then it's his job again. That's what I got to do. Yeah. Anyway, time's up. Thank you for being here for me.